So this is our concluding session, and it's an open session for you to ask questions, offer comments, reflections. I'll try to keep my answers short so more of you will have a chance to ask, although I'm not very good at that.
You were talking about before how-tos or whatever you call them, and we now know that that mindfulness has been used by psychiatrists. It's now a treatment on the NHS.
Sorry, a what?
A treatment,
yes.
Depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we also know that multinational companies are now giving their workers a time to do mindfulness, presumably to increase their productivity. So how do you make sense of how something that the Buddha put forward is actually useful as an antidepressant and also is useful for multinational companies for their employees?
I'm repeating the question, so of course. The question has to do with the use of mindfulness, an idea, a practice that the Buddha came up with 2,500 years ago, and how it is now being effectively used in healthcare to treat such things as relapse into depression, and how it is also being utilized by multinational companies and found to be effective in helping their workforce too. So the questioner would like to know what I think about all of this and how come something that was developed so long ago suddenly has relevance today. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Well, this is a question that, not surprisingly, comes up a great deal today. And I find myself both reflecting on it and having to answer it in different settings. First of all, I think this is a wonderful thing. And on a number of counts. I think it's something that has been found to be helpful in the alleviation of human suffering. And that was clearly the Buddha's project all along. So the fact that it can be applied in completely non-religious or secular settings and still, you know, have effects, to me indicates that the Buddha was onto something, if we put it like this. And I also feel that mindfulness is not just some marginal exercise or practice that you might find in a few monasteries in Mongolia or somewhere, but actually mindfulness is right at the very heart of the early Buddhist teaching. You have, it's one of the steps of the Eightfold Path, for example. It's a central practice in early Buddhism, even described, albeit probably rather rhetorically, as the direct way to nirvana. So it's a very central practice. But it raises a number of questions. The first, perhaps, is somewhat along the lines of what I was saying, is that it seems to show that what the Buddha came up with was more a therapeutic strategy that was effective in coming to terms with and working with human suffering, more than it was a theory of how a theory about the nature of reality and how to free oneself from delusion, which is how Buddhism has often become. So in some ways it's a sort of confirmation, I find, for emphasizing how the Buddha's teaching is primarily therapeutic. It's to be judged not in terms of whether it's true or false, but in terms of whether it works or not. It needs to be put to the test, which has always been one of the criteria in Buddhist tradition, is, you know, does it work? That has to be the basic line, not is it true, to go back to what I was saying this afternoon. We also have to recall that the Buddha quite explicitly compared himself to a physician, to a doctor. He compared his teaching to a form of treatment or therapy. He compared his community to nursing staff. So clearly he was aware of how what he was teaching had some sort of healing property. And again, we could argue that its application in these non-Buddhist areas is once again a confirmation of that insight. It's now being tested under clinical conditions and is shown to be effective under certain conditions. We must be careful not to make too exaggerated claims. The research is still in its infancy. It may in the end turn out not to be quite as effective as a lot of its Buddhist cheerleaders would like to imagine. But I find it probably the most remarkable thing that has happened in my 40 years of involvement with Buddhism, in terms of how something that in the 70s and 80s was the pastime of a bunch of ex-hippies, in a very sort of, you know, marginal sort of area in society, has suddenly become mainstream. And we get, you know, Bill Clinton and all sorts of otherwise worldly people practicing it. So I think it's a great thing. And I would argue that it's effective is because the Buddha was onto something basically that worked. It's as simple as that. But it does, of course, lead us to the sorts of questions I explored this afternoon as to what is the Dharma then? Can we understand it purely in terms of therapy, of ethics, as something to do, something that can make a difference in our lives, rather than a religious belief system or a set of metaphysical truth claims? I think it supports my argument rather strongly. At the same time, it would be naive to expect that this mindfulness movement will not become co-opted by the less admirable parts of our modern society. It's become commodified. It's become turned into a sort of consumer item. It's no doubt being used as a kind of element of social prestige or something like that. I'm sure people can use it in all manner of ways that have very little to do with the vision that the Buddha articulated. And so we do need to sort of be aware of that. At the same time, I think what we're witnessing in these years is a window of opportunity. So rather than somehow poo-poo it or say that's not real mindfulness, that's just secular mindfulness, which is one of the ways the Buddhist community distances itself from these movements, I think we need to recognize that this is a window of opportunity that in which not only the meditative skills of the Buddhist tradition might be made more widely available to help people, but possibly the ethics and the philosophy that underpin that practice may likewise be able to be re-articulated and represented in ways that enrich people's practice of mindfulness. So it's not just a technique for solving a problem, but it becomes more and more a way of comporting oneself within one's life as a whole. And that, I feel, is the great challenge for the Buddhist community, to do for Buddhist ethics and Buddhist philosophy what John Kabat-Zinn and others did for Buddhist meditation. So I think there's a tremendous moment here that could have a significant impact on our society, hopefully for the good, and could allow Buddhist ideas to become more mainstream, which I think is probably a good idea. But then I would, wouldn't I?
In a recent talk, Stephen, that I heard on the internet, you mentioned that the Nirvana was the unconditioned, which was freeing yourself from greed, hatred, and delusion. And today, with your talk about pragmatism and just engaging in the present moment pragmatically. And I'm just asking your opinion, because compared to earlier visions that I've heard of Nirvana, you mentioned in your book Faith, Faith to Doubt, that there's a moment of realization, you know, an illumination, and I hear of other teachers talking in the same way, where there's a moment of you know, spark going on. So I'm trying to understand it in terms of, is it this? Is it just engaging, pragmatically engaging, or is there something that goes on, and then that develops into a quality? It seems so that there is or there isn't.
There is or isn't what?
There is. So in some ways, then, with that illumination, there is. An awakening that wasn't there in the past.
There
was a quality that one takes forward.
Okay. The question is about Nirvana and what constitutes it. Is it simply the unconditioned, meaning, as I said in a talk somewhere, the absence of greed and hatred and delusion? Or, as I apparently wrote in another book, some quality of illumination or insight or awakening?
Do you remember? Is faith
the faith to doubt? Yeah.
And I think you mentioned while you're walking in.
Ah, okay, yeah. Yeah, I mentioned an experience I had in India when I was quite young. I didn't call it Nirvana though, and I don't think I used the word awakening.
So it was no. Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just try and sort of sketch this out. Nirvana is one of these words that is used widely both in Buddhist circles and in the popular media. It's the name of a well-known rock band, for example, that has come to have probably as many meanings as there are people who use the word. So we have to be careful if we're going to be utilizing this term in a rigorous way. I'd like to be doing that. And where we find very clearly stated in the Pali Suttas a definition of Nirvana as simply the ending of greed, the ending of hatred, the ending of confusion. We find that that same definition is also used to define the unconditioned and the deathless, and curiously, embracing suffering, which I spoke of this afternoon. That's also defined in the same way. Now, or fully knowing dukkha, fully knowing suffering. So the way I understand this is that Nirvana is not some exotic, transcendent state of enlightenment, as some of its proponents might argue, but it is actually a condition, a possibility that is available to us in each moment as soon as we attend to and respond to our life in a way that's not conditioned by our habitual reactivity. Nirvana is a space, as I sketched this afternoon, in which those instinctive, habitual, reactive patterns have momentarily come to a stop, either by our not having identified with them and fueled them, or simply because they're not operative at a given moment. And we're aware that I'm not feeling attachment or aversion or confusion. I feel still. I feel content. I feel aware. There's something nirvanic in that basic state of human contentment, that basic state of human sanity. And the practice of the Dharma is to optimize, is to expand or make more frequent such qualities of being, qualities of awareness, such that we come to live our life more from that perspective than from the perspective of our egoism and our fears and our greed. So in other words, Nirvana is an ethical space in which we are free to no longer think and speak and act determined by what the Buddhists call greed, hatred, delusion. It will be there one moment, it'll be gone the next. There's nothing permanent about it. And in certain circumstances, I think those moments are also moments of deep insight and illumination. In other words, although I wouldn't have described what you referred to in my book, The Faith to Doubt, as an experience of nirvana, it's never crossed my mind to think of it that way. But nonetheless, I think there are moments in all human lives, whether you're Buddhist or whatever, in which your normal, everyday, habitual view of the world is suddenly interrupted and replaced with another mode of awareness and consciousness. And this is reported frequently in all traditions. And again, I think such moments are nirvanic in the sense that they tend to emerge when we're no longer under the influence or the control of our habitual, egotistic, self-centered, reactive states of mind. But I think it more helpful, rather than aspiring to attain more and more of these kinds of illuminated moments, to try to integrate that kind of attention into the actual currents of our ordinary life. If nirvana is an ethical experience, then it has to do with allowing us the freedom to live, to make choices, to act in a way that's more creative, more imaginative, perhaps more empathetic, more caring, hopefully more wise. Nirvana opens up that possibility, and it's just a way of speaking about that. And it's integral to these four tasks because it's number three. It's experiencing the stopping of reactivity. That is the experience in nirvana. And it's not the goal of the path at all. It's actually what allows the Eightfold Path or this way of life to come into being, to become operative. It's the clearing, the open space that enables us to live, hopefully, in a way that's more fulfilling and more flourishing. But it requires work and it requires ongoing engagement and attention. That's kind of how I would understand it now.
And just one
quickly.
So the nirvanic space, you say, comes and goes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. And that is not a particularly strange thing to say. All Buddhist traditions recognize that. They might not say it in quite that way. But certainly the Buddha wasn't psychologically naive. He didn't believe that, you know, once you get this glimpse, then you'll be in that state forever. No. Not at all. Yes.
It's just a question about...
Can you speak up a bit?
It was just a question about the relationship of the different forms of knowledge you sketched out at the end of your talk, of knowing how knowing that is, the relationship of that to different forms of truth you talked about, or as I understood it, alluded to in the talk. So I just wanted to clarify my understanding of what you said in your talk, just to set the question up to make sure I'm not getting this wrong. So my understanding was, we're incomplete, so we by nature we're incomplete finite beings, so we grasp at things. One of those is can be absolute truth to fill in various holes in our experience, our lives, and what we're doing. And absolute truth being something that's fixed and unchanging, and it's essentially getting it. Once we've got this, then we've got the answer in the context that is. In place of that is a recognition of the fact that we ourselves, everything about us, is dependent on causes and conditions. So it's continually in flux, everything's changing. An appropriate response to that, as I believe you've sketched out, is to try and live authentically, to try and be truthful in what we're doing as far as we can, which implies a pragmatism, i.e. doing the best we can with what we've got where we are, and that in itself implies a humility, i.e. what we do will always be incomplete, there will always be some residual dissatisfaction because we're complete. In service of that, you've emphasised knowing how over knowing that, i.e. skillful adaptation over a series of steps of conceptual knowledge in advance, so being pragmatic, being able to adapt to things rather than having a knowledge of whatever it is and the series of steps of how we get to whatever the it is, whether it's happiness or whatever. Could you say a little bit about the interdependence of knowing how and knowing that for the type of practice you envisage? Because I was thinking, for example, of say I rather than absolute truth, say something like a stable knowledge claim. So I know I learned some fact about the physiology of a certain group of species, which
changes how I understand their ability to feel pain or suffer or apprehend the world, which itself changes my ethical orientation to them. But how I enact that knowledge may be dependent on what kind of skills I've developed. So could you say a little bit about that?
Okay, I'm not going to try and... but I think the question summarised, I think, quite well what I've been trying to say in my talk and have written about elsewhere, and I'm not going to try and repeat what he said. But the core of the question really lies in the relationship between our knowledge about facts, our knowing that, let's say, for example, if I know more about the physiognomy of a particular creature, then I will have a better understanding of how that creature might feel or not feel pain, and a knowing how, which is a pragmatic way of actually dealing skillfully with given situations as they arise, and what would be the interdependence or the connection between the two. I mean, clearly, our knowledge of the world that we've acquired through the natural sciences does afford us insight, let's say, into the nature of, let's say, how animals feel or don't feel. We both have gone beyond a crude anthropomorphism, where we think that animals are just little human beings in sort of weird bodies, and also we've gone beyond the idea that animals are just machines. They're just sort of unfeeling automata that just are driven by... So our knowledge of how an animal, for example, works and lives and functions necessarily helps us in making ethical and other choices as to how to treat that creature. So I do see the two as very much interdependent. But and what I'm actually sort of trying to go beyond is the assumption that there is a kind of a finality of knowledge, which in religion would be called an absolute truth, an ultimate truth that is given for all time, as opposed to the empirical understanding we might gain through research, through studying in different scientific disciplines and so on, which is an open-ended inquiry. It's not something that, well, perhaps some people would argue that there's going to be some final end point at which we'll know it all, and then we can just sort of stop doing science and just get on with playing golf or something. I think that's extraordinarily unlikely. I think that understanding is an ongoing project. At least that's how I would see it. And so... what we come to know empirically about other forms of life or psychologically say about ourselves. This affords us information, this affords us knowledge that necessarily informs how we then behave, how we act. I'm not suggesting that all knowledge has to sort of just be eliminated, but it's really the question of what kinds of knowledge are helpful in supporting our ethical and pragmatic, let's say even our spiritual life. That's the important point, I think, at the back.
Suggesting that one of the errors of seeking absolute truth is that it by definition is prescriptive to certain ends by the people who define what it is. I was wondering, mathematics deals with this by creating things like absolute zero, imaginary numbers. Mm-hmm. They feel it necessary to include this in the mathematical theory in order to carry on. I'm wondering whether perhaps that is perhaps the paradox of that one is sort of torturing with Buddhism.
Yeah, the question, which I don't really understand, is to do with how perhaps the positing of absolute truths in Buddhist history is perhaps comparable to the positing of absolute numbers, did you say?
Oh, absolute zero. Imaginary numbers which mathematicians need to make.
Yeah.
To carry on.
Okay, so in other words, imaginary numbers that mathematicians need in order to be able to do their work effectively. So in other words, these ideas are, as it were, of pragmatic value to realise, you know, the work that's being carried out in that field. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I'm dubious because I feel the reason, and again, I'm not certain about this, it's an open question for me. My sense is the reason that why Buddhists and others adopted a language of ultimate truth was not for pragmatic purposes, but in order to arrive at ultimate truth claims that gave them the feeling of being right and being certain as a basis for two things. As a basis for being able to promote their cause within a conflicting, competing environment of different religions in India. I think that the Jains and the Hindus certainly claimed to have access to ultimate truth, which they thought of as God or eternal soul or something like that. And I think the Buddha actually wanted nothing whatsoever to do with that way of thinking. But his followers, it seems, for whatever reasons, gradually drifted into that same kind of mindset. And the other reason I think that absolute truth and such and comparable ideas is so attractive is because it serves the interests of power elites. In other words, I don't think you can ever separate claims to truth with claims to power. In other words, and this is very explicit in certain forms of Buddhism, where the person who has realized ultimate truth is also the person who's in charge of the organization. And that person wields enormous power because it's believed, or such a person has persuaded other people to believe, that in fact they are enlightened or something, or that they are omniscient or whatever. And this gives them authority. And I think that served, practical purposes in Asian societies. But I think it was at the cost of actually compromising what was original and distinctive about what the Buddha taught at his time. I think Buddhism slipped into becoming a rather more predictable and stereotype orthodox religion, which I think is, much of Buddhist religion today is of that sort, and that's what we're familiar with. And so I don't really think that they were doing the mathematical thing. Some of the philosophers might have been. I have no way of knowing. But that's not my sense. Yes?
The idea of truth as practice, in contrast to knowledge attainment, it seems very similar to me to the ancient Greek practice of parousia, which, if I understand it correctly, is sort of an ethically bound, a duty to speak the truth again. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you had any comments on the relationship.
Yeah, I do. I'm glad you brought that up. My hunch, and again, I can't be certain about this, but my hunch is that early Buddhism, in other words, what we can reconstruct about the life of the historical Buddha, his community, the social, religious, economic world in which he operated, and the political context of that time, not only within but beyond India into the Persian Empire, was very comparable to the conditions under which particularly Hellenistic philosophy emerged. And in fact, we know that at least one of the Hellenistic schools, Skepticism, founded by Pyrrho, was created by somebody who actually went to India. Pyrrho was accompanied Alexander. Some of Pyrrho's fragments suggest ideas that are very close to, for example, the passage I read out about neither is nor is not. That is the standard skeptical starting point. There's some evidence from Greek sources that Democritus, who was the founder of atomism, and also by implication skepticism, likewise visited India. And this would have been before Pyrrho, around the Buddha's time. So I think there are very close family resemblances between the early Buddhist teaching and practice and communities that we're beginning to understand better now, and the contemporaneous communities and teachings and practices of the early skeptics, the Epicureans, and the Stoics. Unfortunately, nobody's really looked into this in any great detail. We know a great deal more now about the practices of the Hellenistic philosophers, who, as you say, were essentially practicing ethics. They described what their practice was as ethical, as an ethical practice. And there are many, many resonances and parallels and similarities between the style, let's say, of Epictetus or of Epicurus and the style of life and teaching and practice of what we find in the Pali Canon. So I think there is actually a possibility, I would even argue a good possibility, that these traditions are emerging out of a similar thought world. They are certainly arising out of a similar economic, social, and political environment. And possibly by going back to the to reconstructing Gautama and his teaching might actually enable us to recover commonalities between those teachings and practices with teachings and practices at the roots of our own Western tradition. And there are people, I think, who are now exploring these possibilities. It's interesting that people like Michel Foucault and who else? And I'm now reading Peter Sloterdijk in the German philosopher. They're all going back to this idea of practice. And that, I think, is something to which I think there's a very rich or potentially very rich dialogue that can could emerge between the comparative study of these two traditions. That'll be another book, though, I'm afraid.
I understand that the Buddha also said what worked was bhavana, and you seem very dismissive of that. The cultivation of expansive qualities when somebody asked about metta. Mm. Because, I mean, I can't know the truth of this, but it seems to me that my experience of practicing, say, samatha and jhanas has led to huge freedom and release. So I felt you were a bit dismissive of that.
No, I'm not dismissive. I mean, again, remember bhavana. We have metta bhavana, karuna bhavana, and so on. And I assume you're referring to bhavana in that sense.
Well, cultivation of expansive qualities like those, but yes, I think it also comes into samatha and jhana. So you're practicing expansive qualities in that.
Yes.
And therefore it leads to a space in which great insight happens for people for whom that works. Yes. I mean, it doesn't work for everybody.
No, thank you. I think that's good. I was just a little confused by the use of the word bhavana.
Well, it is cultivation in samatha. You are cultivating certain qualities.
Yes.
Similarly with metta, but that's a slightly different practice where you repeat certain phrases. It's a different practice, but it is a cultivation.
Yes, no, absolutely. But the broader meaning of bhavana extends even further. Bhavana, the whole of the Eightfold Path is to be bhavanad.
Yeah, but I'm talking about...
You're talking about these expansive qualities. Which personally, I don't... I've not really, myself, been terribly drawn to. I have done some of these practices, but they don't really work terribly well for me.
But they do work for a lot of people.
They work for a lot of people, and again, I think I said at least once this afternoon that we must be careful not to think of practice as being reducible to one or two or three things. That the Buddha presented this this range of approaches, and I think he did that because he recognized that people have different temperaments and needs. And so so certainly the cultivation of the jhanas or the deep states of absorption, metta, karuna, and so on have been found to be extraordinarily effective forms of practice for many people. I've never been involved in I've never done jhana practice, but because I do get called on this quite frequently, I've signed up for Lee Brasington's jhana retreat at Gaia House this summer. So rather than talk about it, I would like to actually get more first-hand experience of it. Well, okay, then I'll cancel Lee's. But you've got to start somewhere. Lee's it fits well with my schedule.
I just wondered if it's... I'm not sure about this, but could you sort of use truth in the sort of way you could say it's almost a truth that we can't experience the reality of anything? And that could be quite helpful in that the deeper levels at which you get that we can't actually experience reality, is it in itself freeing? And that you could use truth a bit like that?
Yeah, you see, I think that's very close to what Nagarjuna did.
Right.
I mean, the idea of emptiness, as it's understood philosophically, is that in the end, you cannot arrive at some essential reality or truth. That however much you investigate or look deeply into anything, you will just keep going.
Yeah.
You won't get to a buck stops here moment. And that's classical Madhyamaka philosophy. And that has been traditionally understood as understanding ultimate truth. Mm-hmm. Paradoxically, ultimate truth for Nagarjuna and the Madhyamaka philosophers means arriving at the understanding that ultimately nothing is findable. There is simply an infinite, in a sense, an endless quest that doesn't, in a sense, lead to anything utterly final, but also doesn't lead to nothing.
But it's freeing.
It is freeing, absolutely. Yeah. It is the primary metaphor for achieving freedom, is to free oneself from the idea that there are things or essences locked into myself or into the world that, you know, can be accessed by philosophy or meditation, whereas in that Buddhist philosophical tradition, that is basically treated with thoroughgoing scepticism. And in that sense, actually, I think Madhyamaka philosophy and a number of passages in the early texts are fairly close to the early forms of Greek scepticism. I think we're going to have to stop here. It's 5:20. You have, Louise, some concluding announcements to make?
It was to thank you very much.
That's okay.
For a great day, worth a lot of